Thank you for tuning in to Not Suitable for Anyone. As a reminder, if you'd like to financially support the show, don't. Just help other people find us by leaving a rating on iTunes or just telling a friend. If you do want to put your hard-earned dollars to work to support our mission, here's what you can do. Buy or rent movies. Redbox, iTunes, Vudu, it doesn't matter. Hell, even an old-fashioned Blu-ray. Leave a review on Letterboxd or Amazon and tell them that you heard about it right here on
Not Suitable for Anyone.
Hey everybody, and thanks for tuning in to episode 35 of Not Suitable for Anyone. As always, I am your host, Patrick Anderson, and I am delighted to bring you an exciting show today. I'm really looking forward to it. We got a lot of cool stuff on the agenda here today. We're gonna talk about some snake dick. I don't know if snakes have dicks, but we're gonna talk about it, and we're gonna get into it. We're gonna talk about some roller rink slasher stuff. We're going to talk about bodies decomposing, and we're going to talk about a guy who gets turned into a meat sandwich. All that is coming up here today on episode 35, so really excited about it. I have a special guest that'll be joining us in the main segment. His name is David Cornelius, who made a movie called Inhumanwich. So stick around for that for sure. But as always, before we get into that, I want to run down the latest news, the latest updates. I'm going to kick it off again with a short film, and I have teased this out for a couple of weeks. If you guys have stuck with me, then you deserve the payoff. You deserve a little snake dick. Who doesn't want a little snake dick in their life? This is a short that was written and directed by David Mamoudier, who is a British filmmaker now living in L.A. Made this film a few years back and got it released onto the Alter YouTube channel, which is run by Gunpowder and Sky. You might remember those guys. They did a movie called Prospect, which is fantastic. It's a little sci-fi thriller set on an alien planet with Pedro Pascal and Jay Duplass. Really, really cool movie. They do some cool stuff there at Gunpowder and Sky, and the Alter YouTube channel is fantastic, and you should absolutely check it out, and you should start with Snake Dick, because it's fucking awesome. And I'm going to kind of break it down for you right now, but if you want to stop and go watch it, I encourage you to do that, because I keep saying this, it's awesome. And it's 7 minutes. So, you know, it literally costs you nothing. I'm going to talk through it, because it's a 7 minute short. So I'm not really, you know, worried about spoilers. And if you're really that concerned about spoilers for a 7 minute short, then just take the 7 minutes and go watch the fucking short. Okay. Get off my back. I'm talking about it, and I'm talking through it, and that's all there is to it. Can't stop me. Jill and Julia pull into a gas station in the dead of night. Steam pours from the hood of their car. They pop the hood and grab their toolkit, while two catcalling redneck assholes pester them. The girls are on a mission, evidenced by Julia telling Jill to keep it in her pants because
I've got far worse pricks to deal with.
One of the hillbillies makes a come here gesture with his index finger. Frustrated, Jill walks up to him and asks what he wants, which gives us this delightful gem of a line.
I bet my friend here, I can make you come with one finger. Just imagine what I could do with my whole hand!
Distracted with how proud he is of this stupid joke, he doesn't notice Jill pull out a handgun and point it at his head, suggesting something else that she could do with just the flick of her finger. After making him squeal like a pig because, get it? Men are pigs! Yeah, it's a little broad, but the heckler's buddy thinks he's had enough. Now, how often have we heard this? Some guy gets called out for shitty behavior, and the other guy says, okay, you proved your point, now leave us alone. But they're not going to change. And in fact, he proves it by pulling out a knife. Julia, to defuse the situation, starts playing her flute. Before we know what's happened, a giant snake emerges from between Jill's legs and bites asshole number one on the face. A voiceover from Julia explains that alone, they're nothing, but together, they have a powerful weapon in the fight against evil. As their car drives into the desert, we see LA burning in the background. Like I said, this short is fucking awesome, and you should check it out. It's lit really well. The cinematography is great. It looks fantastic. It was filmed, shot on an Arri Alexa. It's really, really well made, professionally made short, with the snake effects done in post that honestly look really, really cool. They shot this in only 8 hours. They had one night, and they picked, I guess, apparently the shortest night of the year, but they got it done, and it looks absolutely amazing. According to the interviews I checked out with the filmmaker, they're still working on the script for the feature, but stop me if you've heard this one before, but it's going to be set against the backdrop of an election where you have a very misogynistic male candidate, bombastic type, running against the potentially first ever, who would be the first ever female president. And of course, our two main characters hold the key to stopping his electoral chances. So there is kind of the setup for this. I'm really excited, and I'm really encouraged based on, you know, a lot of the technical aspects of the short. I think it looks really fantastic. I like the idea where you have these two, you know, sort of co-leads that have to work together, where, you know, by combining their skills, they have this weapon that they can use. I think that's an interesting idea, and I like it. I'm curious, you know, where they're going to take it. This is very obviously a sort of a takedown of, you know, toxic masculinity, if you will. And that's where some of my concerns lie, because you've got a male director, male writer, at least for the short, as far as the short is concerned, a male producer. You know, this is obviously telling what is supposed to be a story that is empowering to women. You know, it would be probably prudent to see some female influences on there. I think, you know, the actors should have, you know, some influence on how the characters are portrayed, but, you know, that I just being honest, that, you know, maybe a little bit of a concern, going in, is, you know, who is telling the story and how's it going to come out? Because, like I mentioned, I mean, this short is a little broad. There's a whole, you know, section about pigs. It's painting with a broad brush, but again, these types of people exist. You know, it makes sense, and it's really, you know, a short to show off, you know, their filmmaking capabilities, which they obviously have, world building capabilities, which I think they have definitely shown here. So I'm really excited. So there you go, guys. Finally, after, you know, teasing it out for a couple of episodes, there is Snake Dick, writer director David Mamoudier. Definitely, you know, if you're listening, would love to talk to you about the short and about the feature and your plans. Would love to do an episode down the road. Okay, so that's Snake Dick. There you go. Happy? I hope so. Okay, I got a new trailer this week. It made a few rounds on Twitter to mixed reaction, but I'm interested. It's called Death Rink. And yeah, it's a slasher set at a roller skating rink.
He was epileptic, and he had a seizure because of the strobe lights, collapsed on the floor, and then got ran over by the speed skate session.
It's about a skating rink where a kid apparently got run over by speed skaters and died. So I assume that has something to do with the slasher villain, but I don't know. The trailer is not very long, and you don't really get a ton of information beyond that little clip. Other than that, it's just, you know, a few clips of our characters and then some shots of the killer in the mask. So it's really hard to say exactly what's going on here. This one doesn't come out till May. So I am going to, try to get a look at it when the screener comes out, but until then, you know, probably won't be able to find out much more. The director is a guy named Daniel Zubiate, and it looks like he's working on a series of workplace slashers, or workplace horror, because besides this one, he's got one called Last Call, which looks like a slasher set at a bar, and he's got one that they're working on now, or that they just shot, called Midnight Screening, which is a slasher also set in the 80s at a movie theater. So it seems to be a kind of a pattern. You might have heard about this one earlier under a different title. It may have gotten either a partial release or a festival run under the name Skateway Massacre, but now it's coming out from Wild Eye Releasing under the name Death Rink, with some new artwork. It looks pretty cool, but if you're looking for it on Facebook or something like that, you need to look for Skateway Massacre. Look, a lot of the people online are complaining that it looks cheap, and it does. The color grading is not great, but the cinematography looks at least halfway decent. It seems like they know how to frame a shot, and, you know, just may not have the best cameras to work with and the most money to spend on color grading and things like that. So it has that kind of cheaply made look, which I love. It's set in the 80s and it's a slasher, so I'm definitely going to check it out. So, that's our Something Short, Something Long segment. Something Dumb is coming up in the main segment. That's Inhuman, which, there's no other word for this movie. It's a dumb movie, but it's supposed to be, and that's not an insult, and I think David would be, sort of the first to kind of get on board with that. So we'll put a pin in Something Dumb and come back for that in the main segment. But first, I need to talk about Something Wrong.
What have I done?
Yes, and that is Thanatomorphose. I really hope I'm pronouncing that right, but I don't fucking know. I've talked about this a little bit online. If you follow me on Twitter at FinHorror, I've talked about it there a little bit. This is a movie I caught, maybe about a year ago. It's a little bit hard to find. It's only on, I think, Apple iTunes or Apple Movies, or whatever it's called, is, I think, one of the only places digitally that you can see it, at least in the U.S. It might be a little more widely available in Canada. And until recently, it was only available on DVD in the States from Unearthed Films, which I literally just bought. And then, much to my surprise and delight, the good folks over at Tetra Video released an ultra-limited Blu-ray edition, limited initially to 50 copies only. As of the time I'm recording this, there are still 10 copies left. And if those copies run out, there is still a standard Blu-ray that you can buy as well. But I do have the ultra-limited Blu-ray on order, and I am really, really looking forward to that. This is a gross, disturbing movie, and there's not much else I can say about it. It's all about this woman's psychological and physical deterioration, which happens on screen in front of you. I mean, this is a classic Canadian body horror. It's disgusting. It's story-wise, somewhat similar to Contracted, only much, much better, in my opinion. It's really amazing. I'll just read the synopsis here. It says, discovering several bruises on her body after a night of rough sex, a young woman is shocked as, rather than heal itself, her body begins rotting from the inside out. She faces a terrifying and gory descent into a living death as her putrefying body begins to fall off the bone. Whether that description does it for you or doesn't do it for you, I say follow your instincts on that. I thought it was really amazing. I thought the effects work, the makeup effects and body horror and sound design and even the physical performances all were really, really amazing. This does take place in a single location in an apartment. So, you know, if that is a problem for you, you know, it's something to be aware of. It's extreme disturbing body horror. That's also something to be aware of. I like the extreme stuff, and I think, you know, we need to kind of, you know, face those fears sometimes. So, you know, if you are so inclined, I encourage you to check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes on where you can get that Blu-ray, and also link the article that I did over at Modern Horrors talking about it, and another movie that Tetro just dropped as well called Cannibal, with another a very limited edition. The limited edition on that one is sold out, but I think there's still DVDs available. There you go. You wanted something wrong. You got something wrong. It's disgusting, and I'm excited to bring it to you. Okay, so getting into our main topic, joining me right now is going to be David Cornelius. We're going to talk all about his film Inhuman Witch.
Mission Control, Argo 1. Mission Control to Argo 1. How you doing up there, Joe?
In the not-too-distant future, the United States will make a celebrated return to capsule-based space travel.
The launch was pretty wild. Nothing quite like riding a 10-ton Roman candle to the top of the sky.
Astronaut Joe Newman will enter outer space as a man.
We certainly aren't expecting any frightening catastrophes anytime soon, right, Doc?
He will return.
The waste! From the core, it's starting to spill over.
What do you make of this?
As something else.
The levels of radiation and other toxins inside the Argo 1 are astronomical.
Oh, no! No!
A strange new adventure. Thirty-six months in the making. Inhuman Witch.
That was quite fun. And I sure did learn a lot, too.
David Cornelius from Cincinnati, the Queen City, as it were, the director, writer, creator of Inhuman Witch. David, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Great, man. Thanks for joining me to talk through this wacky movie.
Yeah, no problem, man.
When I first saw the title, I think I assumed it was Inhuman Witch.
We get that a lot.
Yeah.
And I intentionally it didn't happen until we released the movie, because I guess we didn't think that anyone would read it wrong. And the first person that read it wrong, I decided, well, it's a made-up word anyway. You can read it however you want. So you can pronounce it in Human Witch if you wanted. I'm cool with it.
This is a very Midwestern movie. And, you know, Sloppy Joes are one of those sort of classic, you know, home-cooked Midwestern meals. It plays an integral role in the plot of this film. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can't stand Sloppy Joes. So, the amount of Sloppy Joes I had to eat at, you know, at the premiere and at on set and everything, it was rough. For the premiere, we thought it would be cute to have it. And I figured, well, everyone else likes them. My wife makes really good Sloppy Joes for, you know, some of the, you know, that rare Sloppy Joe that I like. So she made a batch and we chowed down on it. It was fun. But yeah, we had a couple times on set when we were on location, whoever was hosting us would make some Sloppy Joes for lunch. And okay. You just kind of grin and bear it there, I guess.
That's great. This is an unusual movie because it is very much a throwback to kind of the 50s style B-horror sci-fi movies. But there's not just pop culture references in the script, but also, like, as part of the story, like, there's modern things going on. Like, I think at one point there's somebody reading, like, an Oprah magazine.
Yeah, we got the first line of the movie is, or first bit of the movie is, he says, it's the not too distant future. And once we said, well, it's the future, we can make it whatever we want. If we want to throw in a cell phone, if we want to throw in a rotary phone, nothing makes sense. And it kind of just gave us a license to do whatever we thought was funny at the time, you know, logic right. Be damned. I've seen people online say, like, well, this makes no sense. They're supposed to be in the 50s and they all have cell phones. And I thought, it's the future. Who cares?
Yeah. I mean, the movie does, I guess, try to kind of clue you in that we're not seeing something necessarily set in the past, although you're definitely, I think, you're definitely kind of aping that style, but with, you know,
and I think,
modern.
You know, yeah. I think if people do go into it thinking, well, this is the, you know, the future as it was in a 50s movie, I can see where they would complain about, you know, modern stuff in there. But it's one of those you just laugh it off. You're like, well, it was, you know, it makes for a good joke on the screen. I'm okay confusing people for a while.
Okay. And so I'm curious, because you have had a career as a writer, you know, film critic, things yeah. like that. So I guess when you decided to make a movie, why this movie?
This is going back quite a ways. At the end of my film critic days, I also hosted a TV show for local TV called Friday Night Foo. It was, we would show kung fu movies and then we would have host segments where we would joke around. And a bunch of us got together. We liked working together. So we would work on some 48-hour film projects. If you've heard of that contest where mm-hmm. you have 2 days to make a short film. And we liked doing that a lot. And one day we just started joking about a movie about an astronaut who becomes a sandwich. And I thought, like, well, I'll just start writing it and I'll see what happens. And if it's a short, it's a short. If it's a feature, it's a feature. Not realizing that for your first movie, you should do a short, because jumping into a feature right away is a really bad idea because you get over your head really fast. But we kept going anyway. And so, yeah, most of the crew, a lot of the cast, we were all from the Friday Night Foo show. And it just sort of, it was one of those things where it's like, well, we're not doing the show right now. We like working together. Let's just do this dumb meat monster thing.
With low budget movies, like, it can go either way. Sometimes you sort of have to get in and get out and shoot everything in 5 or 10 days. Sometimes it's a day here, a day there over a span of months. So I'm just kind of curious sort of how this came together and what the time frame was like.
We were lucky enough to get a lot of people eager to just waste their weekends on this. So we, at the beginning, mapped out, I believe it was from late February through the end of April. And this was back in 2011. So So we had every Saturday and Sunday with one or two days off for a rain delay. We had a day for shooting. And we were also lucky enough where we would just go until we were finished, as opposed to, I've done other shoots where it's like, well, we have to be out of here at 3 o'clock, or I got to be somewhere at 2. Whereas this one, we had the luxury of saying like, well, we've got all day. We can make the most of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think it came out to something like 12 or 14 shooting days, just not in a row, but we managed to, I know some indie movies, they do, like you said, they'll do one weekend and then wait 2 months and then do another weekend. Whereas we had a very strict schedule that we were lucky enough to be able to keep.
Yeah, I love the you know, sort of the opening scene when you have Joe the astronaut in space, and he's on the video monitor, and the president of the United States comes in, and there's something in the walls behind him that I guess is supposed to kind of be like, you know, part of his space capsule or something, but it just looks sort of like some regular walls, and you've stuck some vents or.
Yeah, it's kind of we had our sound guy, who is now my cinephotographer on new projects, was also set designer for the spaceship. This is just everyone doing everything. And all he did was he built two like door-sized panels with some foil on them, and he would just glue various things, ran some Christmas lights through them, and we just stuck them in a corner and just shot from there. It was, you know, about, we were in a band practice room, which is about the size of a bedroom to begin with, and we were limited to one corner. So it would be like shooting the whole thing in a bathtub, pretty much. That's about the room we had to work with. But yeah, it was just two sheets of plywood with a bunch of junk glued onto it.
Yeah. That's fine. And it gives it that sort of Ed Wood quality.
Yeah.
I think with the, yeah. You know.
Well, and there was a lot of it where you just have to have faith when the people you're working with, where I didn't see that set until I walked in the day we were filming. So if it was junk, I would have, you know, been in big trouble. So I told Shane, I said, build whatever you want to build, just make it look good. And luckily he made it look good. We had a lot of those where the fake spaceship, the crash site, that was actually my father-in-law built that. And I didn't see it until he wheeled it in the morning of that shoot. Lots of stuff like that, where you just kind of hope that it, it looks something, you know, it looks usable. And I love the dumbness of the stupidity of that spaceship set, because it was just, it's just nothing. It's just Christmas lights and foil, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's fun, and there's that, you know, there's a charm to things like that. Yeah. And even like the control room is, you know, looks like a, you know, looks like a, you know, like a DIY set.
It was a, it's a conference room at a local community center, and we just stole a bunch of monitors from the TV station we were working at the time. And just, we figured, well, as long as they're back by the end of the day, no one will miss them. And yeah, so everything on there was just sort of whatever we could cobble together.
Yeah. In this scene, there's something that happens that kind of becomes a recurring theme throughout the movie, where there's a lot of jokes that just sort of keep repeating, or, you know, sort of keep getting extended. And this is kind of the first one of that, where we talk about Joe's onion allergy. And then he makes like a specific point to say, there's no reason why I should really be talking about this. And there are movies that, you know, sort of over-exposit things to us.
Right, right. And I swear, you know, this was what, 10 years ago that I wrote the movie. That joke about him specifically saying, there's no reason for me to be mentioning this, I swear I stole it from someplace, but for the life of me, I can't remember where I stole it from. So if you're out there and I stole it from you and you're listening, thank you very much. But yeah, it feels very familiar, like something I heard a million times. So I just ran with that.
The whole movie happens because the space agency forgets that, that when it's daytime where they are, it's yeah. nighttime and on right. the other half of the world.
Yeah. yeah, a lot of these jokes, you just try to think of what's the dumbest thing someone can say, and that's just one of them that popped up. So yeah. the entire script was me saying, all right, what's the dumbest thing someone can do here? And I just rolled with that.
And the movie, I think the movie's consistent throughout with that, because you're right. Like every time there's a choice to be made, about a direction that this could go, that's the choice.
Yeah.
That seems like the guiding principle there. The president character cracks me up, especially because this is the first time we see it, but it comes back again where he kind of witnesses something terrible. And like, he clearly has seen what just went on. You know, he watches the guy, you know, turn into a monster yeah. and then the camera shuts off and he goes, well, guys, that was great fun. Like, he's yeah. got to just pretend.
Oh, look at the time. I got to get out of here. Yeah. I would just, as a quick aside, Joe Dean is the guy who played the president.
Yeah.
And when we wrote it and when we were casting it, he was intentionally written to be a Ronald Reagan kind of older doddering guy. And as soon as he walked in the room, I said, that's George W. Bush. And so he got, before he even said a word, we're like, all right, he's got to play the president. And that just, it completely changed the entire tone of that role, toward, I don't know, toward a more W kind of guy.
I could see that where you might write him as kind of senile, but really he's just sort of, you know, clueless and stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
I like his line reading just in that moment where he's like, well, guys, that was great fun. Like you're not really even sure. I wasn't even really sure in that moment where, like, does he just think this is all, you know, entertainment? Or is that all he can think of to say at this moment?
I think with him, it's just he is so clueless that he is just so happy to have seen something on a TV. And that just, now that it's over, he doesn't realize how bad things are.
And then we introduce Joe's wife not long after that on this telephone sequence.
Yeah, that is me. One of my biggest pet peeves is the bit where you only hear one half of the conversation. But since you only hear one half, the person you hear has to essentially repeat what you didn't hear. You know, Bob Newhart had a whole career on that. I think C-3PO and R2-D2, where you got the, oh, don't tell me that, the, you know. And so I just said, like, well, what's happening on the other end of that phone? And this was me kind of just burning off all this hate for that sort of trope.
Okay.
And and they ended up playing it really well. So yeah, I got lucky with how that came out.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, it's funny once you realize that instead you're hearing both sides of the conversation twice.
Yeah. And it's fun. The few times I've seen the movie with an audience, it's fun to kind of listen to when in the scene the audience is picking up on what's happening, because it's never right away. It's usually around halfway through, a few people get it, and then a little bit later, and then by the end, everyone's got it.
Yeah.
And that's just fun to listen to, this sort of like confusion into like, oh, okay, I get what there's going on. It's just goofiness.
Yeah. Well, because it's one of those, it starts out, when it first starts out, and you're like, when you realize what's going on, it's like, oh, okay, that's kind of amusing. And then like, you know, maybe like a line or two later, you're like, all right, now this is really starting to get annoying.
Right.
And then it just keeps going to the point that it's just ridiculous. It's one of those jokes where it starts out kind of funny and then it gets less funny, but then yeah. it goes on so long that it becomes funny again.
That's a lot of the movie, actually. There's a lot of repetition in this thing and a lot of just stretching it out as far as we can. And somehow some of it, yeah, loops around all over again.
Yeah. And then of course the guy, she hangs up before he can ask her to bring some sloppy joes.
Right.
And then she has to go get her medical kit when she gets there, because I guess like the astronaut's wife is also the nurse.
I, She is, aside from the president's wife and the secretary, she's the only female character in the entire movie. And in a lot of those, '50s sci-fi movies, you had the one woman who was there to be a scientist slash cook slash nurse slash cleaning lady all on a rocket ship. And you're like, how is this happening? So yeah, I kind of gave her everything.
And she's great. She's hilarious in this. There's some funny like scene blocking and editing jokes where, you know, she says, oh, I better go grab my medical kit. And so, she walks off, and then some of the guys are still standing around talking. And then the camera, you know, kind of tightens in, and he's saying something. I forget the exact line, but he's saying something about how he must be in terrible agony and all this pain and stuff. And then the camera pans out, and she's still standing right there, right next to him. And I think that joke shows up, I think, in more than one scene.
Yeah, I want to say about two or three more times. Yeah.
Oh yeah, because they're talking about how he's definitely in hell and
right, yeah.
There was just a
long rant about in that one it's about how much it would be better off if he was dead because he's got to be in such horrible agony. And then later on there's one that they said like if he is dead, he's definitely in hell because he's too horrible a person to go to heaven. Yeah, pretty much everything bad you can say around a grieving widow.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Good stuff. And then by the time the monster the inhuman which shows up, you know, you start to realize that nobody really is spared in this movie. You're eating children, you're eating dogs. Yeah. It's whatever's in his path, basically.
Yeah, pretty much whatever. When I was writing, it was just like whatever I thought would be funny for him to attack next.
Yeah,
kids or priests or anybody, just let him go at it.
And I'm curious because the creature effect is obvious as I assume like a CG composited effect. But did you have something on set for?
There's a first, the first time you see, before Joe is completely transformed, there's a bit where you can see like some gunk on his face and he's got stuff on his arm. But other than that, everything was just, yeah, we'll paste it in later. We'll figure it out later. So it was quite a long time before we figured out exactly what he would look like. We did some tests before we shot using real, first we tried real meat, like real Sloppy Joe, and that stunk up the room really bad. we would do like close-ups where I would cover my hand with Sloppy Joe and move it around to see how that would look. And it didn't quite look right. So they ended up, long after we finished filming, they ended up building a puppet that they would film from different angles, and then the effects guys kind of tweaked it some to add tentacles and to make it larger and throw an eyeball in there and stuff like that.
Okay.
But yeah, none of that was on set. Every single person we dealt with, every actor we just had to say, all right, look on that half of the screen. There's going to be something. We don't know yet, but just roll with it. And they did fine.
Yeah, that's great. So did you just kind of shoot the puppet on a, like against a green screen or something? And then,
I think so. The problem is one of the reasons it took so long, post-production, because we finished filming, spring 2011, and we didn't finish the movie until December 2016.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of it was my DP, who is also a major effects guy, moved to California right after we finished shooting. And when you know, I'm in Ohio, he's in California, there's a lot of waiting, a lot of phone tag. So at times he would just send stuff to our editor and I would look at it and say, like, all right, I have no idea how you did that, but okay. Yeah, it was my editor that told me, like, yeah, they're doing a puppet. I'm like, sure, all right, whatever works.
There's that scene in Ed Wood where, you know, where Johnny Depp is telling, you know, Bela Lugosi that, oh, this is the, you know, this is the giant squid or whatever, and it's just a thing right on the ground. Like, it's not, it doesn't.
You gotta wiggle it around.
Yeah, he's like, just wiggle your arms a little bit. It'll look fine.
That's, yeah, that was, there's one death scene where the guy, he's just sort of slowly devoured, and all we had to do was just tell him, yeah, just kind of keep wiggling and just just look down at yourself and just kind of move around and it'll look like you're being eaten later. And he rolled with it, so yeah.
There's, I mean, everyone looks like they're having fun, you know.
Yeah, it was a total blast to make.
Yeah, it looks that way. Yeah, it's so, and they're just doing the goofiest stuff, like the guy, like this. So they find all these skeletons, and I guess there's like little bits of like residual, you know, sloppy Joe residue on them, and like the one guy keeps eating it.
Well, yeah, the scientist Dr. Chang. He decides, well, the best way to test the skeleton is just lick the skeleton. And when I wrote it, I thought, like, okay, yeah, that's just a cute dumb joke. But when Mike, who played Dr. Chang, when he did it on set, I realized, like, all right, that's the poster. That's the defining image of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I love that shot. Yeah, he's so good in it.
Yeah. He's great. And that's a great image. When they cornered the monster in the house, and there's like the large curb next to the driveway, and for some reason he just decides to roll over it instead of like walking around. Or
that was entirely, I wouldn't even call it an ad lib. That was just goofing around on set, where we shot it normally, where he just steps up onto the, I guess, over the garden, and we shot it fine. And then Matt, who plays Ed, and Jake, who plays the general, they're like, can we just try something dumb? And we said, yeah, sure. You know, it's just digital video. Let's roll it. And he did it as a joke. And at the time we thought, like, okay, yeah, that's funny. You know, okay, whatever. And then when we were editing it, we were like, no, that has to be in there. And it's in there for no reason other than just they wanted to goof around on set and we thought it was funny. And now people tell me about it all the time. Like, oh, that was so genius. I'm like, that was not me at all. That was Jake being Jake.
That's funny. So I guess, is there a lot of that in the movie where, I guess, how much of that sort of physical type comedy was scripted, and how much of it was just people having fun, you know, in the moment that seemed to work for the tone of the film?
I'm not sure the exact percentage. Most, like, I'm no good at writing physical stuff. Usually in my scripts, it's really generic, just sort of, and now Dr. Chang walks to the other side of the room. Like, there's no specific direction there of how anyone gets anywhere. So a lot of the physicality of it was entirely the cast. But I also, yeah, we just say we're not shooting on film, it's digital video. Digital video is cheap. So if we want to just keep the camera rolling over and over again, just to see what we can get. And we got some really good stuff. And a lot of it, yeah, if it was a physical thing, it was almost always just them just making the right move at the right time.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's a real, you know, sort of collaboration.
It was definitely, I have a hard time calling it my movie, because I wrote it, I directed it, but there's so much in there that other people did that didn't come from me, and it makes the movie better. So I try to call it our movie.
Yeah, that's good. And it really works. It really works, I think, because of that. Is that kind of your direction when you're shooting, is, you know, just to kind of let people have free rein to experiment?
Yeah, well, I a lot of it is, you know, you'll do one take normally, just to see, you know, how everyone wants to play it. And then if I have a problem with it, I'll fine tune it from there. And then I just tell people, if you have an idea and you want to try something dumb, worst thing we can do is film it and then not use it. I would rather have it, you know, I would rather have it on file if we decide to use it later than have it say, than have us go like, oh, yeah, Mike came up with this great idea, but we decided not to use it. And now I wish we did. I would rather just have all that stuff in the bank. So we just roll a lot. And it makes life hell on my editor because he's got to sort all that stuff out. But we also just roll a lot of Matt, who's my editor. He takes a lot of stuff, a lot of shots that weren't officially takes. Like if we start the camera rolling, but we haven't yelled action yet. If you see somebody do something goofy, early in the movie, Jack, who plays Floyd, Dr. Chang is given a very long speech and they keep cutting back to Floyd making kind of dumb faces at the camera. And that was just Jack waiting for me to call action. He was just goofing around. And Matt decided, yeah, let's take that footage and let's just use it. So, yeah, I just tell people go nuts. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And I mean, and it works. You know, you're sort of letting people, you know, be creative.
Yeah.
With you know, with the material.
And I do, you know, if there is a point where they're going in a completely wrong direction, I'll say like, hey, okay, back it up a bit. Let's try it another way. But usually, yeah, it's the cast I have, you know, they were just really good at trying different things, trying things out, just winging it. Yeah.
It's not one of those that feels like the tone keeps shifting. I mean, it all stays pretty consistent.
Yeah. I credit that to Matt, editor, Matt, who really knows how to shape a movie. This movie was, it looked a little different in the script. It looked a little different where some scenes were all stand. It would be like 5 minutes in the lab and then 5 minutes at the barricade with him shooting at the monster. And he decided, like, he mixed them all up and kind of gave it a pace. And once he locked into that pace, the entire movie kind of, there's no time to get on a different tone because it's going so fast. See, I credit all that to him, just the consistency of it.
One of the guys gets his legs eaten, and so he has, you know, like skeleton.
Yeah,
lower
that's
half for the rest of the movie.
It's one. It's one of my favorite jokes I've ever written, and it was the most hell to shoot, because unlike the monster, where you can just say, okay, we're gonna fill half the screen with the monster later. We had to put Jack in green leggings and then put skeleton legs in front of his legs to make it kind of a half practical effect.
Yeah.
Because we knew we couldn't just CG fake legs in there later. And making that work was kind of insane. So the effects crew really did a good job making that joke work. Because every time I look at it, it makes me giggle.
Yeah, it does, and it looks excellent. I mean, it really looks like he has no legs.
There's one shot where he's supposed to be sitting on a desk, and we figured out, well, if we have him stand behind the desk and make some fake, just put his pants over the desk and fill them with, you know, cotton or something. I don't remember what we used. That was completely fake. There was no green screen there. That was just a practical effect of, I don't know, I wouldn't even call it forced perspective. I would just say, I don't know, he's standing behind his own pants and somehow it looks right.
Yeah.
But everything else, was chromed out, and that's a meticulous amount of work for the effects crew. And yeah, they pulled it off.
Yeah, I bet. Wow. Yeah, because yeah, it looks good, and that's a fun joke, because that's just kind of something he has to deal with for the rest of the movie, trying to figure out, you know, how to get around. He can't really walk.
Yeah, and nobody cares.
Yeah,
nobody cares but him. Yeah.
Yeah, like Joe's wife like ties his pant legs off and you know,
throw some Band-Aids on there, but yeah, but later they all run upstairs and just leave him, or they leave him on the car.
He like drops his crutches. He's trying to get from the Jeep back into the car because they're trying to leave, and everyone just gets in the car without him. And then you have the picnic sequence with the you have the whole musical montage here, which is a little like choreographed musical number that looks like that was fun.
That was me. I love Arch Hall Jr. Not sure if you're familiar with Wild Guitar or Ega. He's just one of any 50s movie where they stop in the middle for no reason to play, because, you know, Arch has to play a rock and roll song. I love those moments. So when I wrote the movie, all I did was I wrote Mitch sings a song. And then I told John, who John plays Mitch, but he also wrote the musical score. And I said, all right, you have just free rein to write a song. And so the entire song was completely him. I sent him some clips of some like rockabilly junk from the 50s. And he said, okay, I got it. And that's what he came up with. And I love it. I love that bit.
Yeah, it's funny. And because it's the song, the lyrics are completely inappropriate for a church picnic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think he sent me, before we had our first table read with the entire cast, he sent me like half the song, just the lyrics. And he said, what do you think? And I looked at him, I'm like, yeah, I don't care. Sure. You can make it work. So I didn't hear the full song. If I'm remembering right, I didn't hear the full song until the table read. So I was with everyone else. That was the first time I heard it. And it gets a little raunchy. And I love it.
So like, did he know that was the context and that was the scene, or you just had him write a song?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I just had him. I think by then he had a copy of the script, so he kind of knew what was going on. But yeah, I just told him, just write some 50s rock song. And that's what he came up with.
Okay. And then you have like your T-1000 Terminator 2 moment here with with the Sloppy Joes at the picnic.
Yeah, that that actually was a miserable day on set. It was kind of cold and rainy, and we couldn't get some of the shots to work the way we did. So I didn't get as much with the Terminator effects as I would have liked. But at the same time, that way, when the hand just comes out of nowhere, kind of makes it funnier to me.
Yeah.
Because there's no explanation of what's happening. It just happens.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, there's a plate of Sloppy Joes, and all of a sudden a hand just pops out and grabs someone.
Yeah.
And then the next thing you know, there's a giant meat monster there.
Yeah. Yeah. And as brutal as that shoot was, just weather-wise, it was a lot of fun figuring out how to have a guy upside down halfway into a plate of food and halfway under the table, and the effect somehow worked. We just we had a good like hour of just poor Shane dangling his legs into the air. And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, how could it not be? You know, you spend your day outside and, you know, getting eaten by a casserole dish full of Sloppy Joes.
Right.
Joe's wife goes out to try and stop him, and she has this really heartwarming monologue that's, you know, like an Indecent Proposal type parody.
Right.
With Tom Hanks. It's just such a ridiculous joke.
That was, when I wrote that paragraph, that was one of those things where I didn't know if it would end up in the movie or not, but immediately I had to like send it to everybody, like, say, here's what the movie is. here's what I just wrote. And they, none of them flinched at it. So I said, all right, I guess we'll roll with it. And that scene was actually the speech she gives was actually about twice as long. The bit I wrote, I think it was like a good page. She just goes on and on and on. And Matt decided in editing, he's like, you know, it'd be funny if you just cut this in half and just have a meter
right.
like right away. And it saved the scene. Cause I mean, there are some, you know, the Tom Hanks joke is funny, but a lot of it kind of dragged. And then once he decided to move up when she dies, it made the scene work.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when you're watching it, you're just waiting for that moment.
Yeah.
You know, because by now, you know what kind of movie it is, and it's, you know, it's not that kind of movie where there's going to be some heartwarming story that's going to, you know, tame the monster that no, eventually he's just going to eat her and move on.
Yeah. And the sooner we could get to that, the better, I think.
Yeah. And then we come to like what I think is the most, I assume, unintentionally prescient moment in the entire movie, which is when the mayor says that he will evacuate the city, but he will not make it mandatory. Right. And it kept me longing.
I didn't even think of that until just now.
I'm longing for a time when that can be satire and parody again.
I didn't even put that together until just now. Holy crap. All right. Yeah. Forget the Simpsons. I'm ahead of the game here.
It's I mean, it's not too far-fetched, because it's a little bit like, you know, it's a little bit like the mayor in Jaws.
Right.
It's just that all of our leaders seem to have become the mayor in Jaws now.
Right.
And then, of course, the mayor then is immediately killed off by the army, not knowing which end of the RPG is the working end.
Right. Yeah, that was another joke that, you know, I liked it on paper, but once I saw how the cast actually pulled it off, I was like, okay, they sold that one.
It was one thing in, you know, like with like the Zucker Brother comedies where they would hire like, you know, serious dramatic actors, you know, guys like George Kennedy or you know, Leslie Nielsen or Lloyd Bridges, and, you know, and that, you know, with the idea that they would be just playing it very seriously and saying these lines and you know, they're the joke, you know, but you're not working with, you know, what, you know, what were, you know, Hollywood sort of leading people at the time. I mean, these are, you know, sort of smaller actors, but they're kind of being asked to do the same thing where it's like, okay, we're going to make this ridiculous and over the top, but you're going to play it, you know, completely straight and serious.
Right. And they had, you know, they had Airplane and they had other movies like that as a guide. So it wasn't like they were just making it up from scratch. They kind of, once you told them, like, you know, hey, this is the kind of movie it's going to be, they knew just between just being smart enough and having the experience of having watched Airplane and other movies that they knew, okay, I know what the tone is supposed to be. And they got it.
Well, again, I guess because, again, every character is making the dumbest decision imaginable. So instead of just saying, hey, everybody pitch in and, you know, and eat this thing.
Right.
It's, we need a competitive eater. We need one person.
We need one guy. And then they all just stand around. Yeah, they all just stand around and go, hey, look at them go. Wish I could help them.
And of course, that guy also is allergic to onions.
Yeah. And that, the whole competitive eater thing was me, as I was writing it, because I don't map out stuff when I write. I just, on the first draft, I just go and see where it takes me, and then I'll go back later. But I got to a point where I'm like, all right, how do we get rid of the monster? And so we thought, okay, competitive eater. Well, no one in the cast is a competitive eater. We just have scientists and wives and stuff, no competitive eaters. And so I just thought, well, why don't we just add one in the last 10 minutes of the movie, and he's the hero of the movie, And should we go back and put him earlier in the movie? No, he just shows up in the last 10 minutes and saves everybody. And to me, that's one of those jokes that's just in there for me. It's like, no one else is going to think that's funny, but I love it.
Yeah, no, it's hilarious. You know, he shows up and he's got, you know, he has to smell the monster so that he knows like what kind of sloppy Joe he's dealing with. And he goes into the thing about how many different recipes there are.
Well, you have to approach each sloppy Joe differently if you're going to be eating an entire monster, you see.
What is he actually eating in that scene?
By that point, we had it down to oatmeal with food coloring. Okay. Because we were shooting in color still. So we thought, all right, we got to, just in case, you know, we're pretty sure we were going to go to black and white. We thought, all right, just in case we keep it in color, we got to make the oatmeal brown. So it was an ungodly amount of oatmeal. And I'm talking like giant containers full, like, I don't know, 10-pound containers or something of just oatmeal that we made overnight and then would just... Yeah, this wasn't fresh oatmeal right off the stove. This was oatmeal that was made the night before, put in my car, had stayed in the car all day, and then it's just him grabbing handfuls of it and just chucking it in.
Wow.
Yeah, and he swallowed some of it, which. Yeah, it was he managed a cookie monster most of it where it looks like he's eating, but he's really just kind of throwing it everywhere.
Right.
And that I think saved him.
Yeah, I mean, I got to give him credit because he looks like he's just chowing down in that.
Yeah.
In
that scene. The final bit where he has one sloppy Joe left and that's all that's left of the monster. I told him, I said, we're going to see you start to eat it, then we're going to cut away, and then we're going to come back, and you're just chewing on it. So all you need to do is take one bite. And instead, he shoved the entire thing in his mouth and swallowed it all in one take. And I said, we're still cutting away from you. You didn't have to do it. And he did anyway, and then he threw up all over the street. So
that's dedication, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we've seen kind of a resurgence in these sort of particularly from the indie scene and these kind of you know, sort of throwback science fiction movies that we sort of grew up on. I mean, even those of us who, you know, didn't necessarily grow up in the 50s, we grew up with Nick at Night and things like that, where we could see things that were, you know, to us, you know, 30 years old and we're probably ancient or now, you know, over half a century old. And I try not to think about that too much. Right. But is that, I guess, you know, is what's, you know, do you have an opinion on that? You know, is this kind of nostalgic phase we're going through?
I don't know if it's a phase or a trend or what. I just know we got really lucky hitting it. Because when we were editing it, that trend hadn't really taken off. There were a few movies out there, but nothing that major. And we thought, no one is going to want to watch this, especially with a dumb, you know, a dumb title with a pun in it, and it's black and white, and this is going to be impossible to sell. And by, you know, in the last couple of years, this tidal wave of, you know, goofy throwback horror movies with silly titles all came crashing down. And I don't know if it's just, I don't think it's everyone saying like, okay, I need a piece of that action. I think it's a lot of independent filmmakers saying like, yeah, I want to make something fun. Let's make some monster movies. And just for some reason, on everyone's mind is, all right, let's make some goofy monster movies with, you know, with a 50s bent. And I don't know where it's coming from. But I'll take it.
Yeah, it's fun because I think you got on. I think your movie got on my radar screen because I was got to be friends with Chance Shirley, made Interplanetary, which is kind of a spin on, you know, like the old 60s like sci-fi TV shows. I mean, even a little bit of Star Trek.
And that movie, not to make Chance blush, but that movie was what got me to make Inhumanwich, because that's the one I saw and said, all right, I need to make something like that. I need to make that.
Wow.
And to this day, when I go to a shoot, usually the night or two before I start filming, I watch Interplanetary just to remind me, like, all right, yes, I'm doing more of that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's great. And it's fun to watch. I imagine it's fun to make.
Oh God. Yeah. There's, as long as you get the right people, I mean, they're, you know, you can get people who do, you can get people who do comedy, who can be a little too serious about it. But if you get the right gang of people, you want to keep working with them over and over again. And if you can, and it's just a blast, because, you know, you're going to be spending an entire day on a miserable set, you know, working with no money, you know, hoping that, you know, the few little things you bought at the grocery store are going to, you know, handle, you know, that's going to keep them fed for the next 6 hours. And if you're going to be dealing with all that, you got to have good people around. And once you have good people around, the whole thing just becomes a lot of fun.
Are you going to stick in the same kind of like a throwback genre, or what's
no,
what are your plans?
The post-production of Inhuman, which burned me out so hard that I said, all right, I don't want to do anything like this. I think at the time I said, I don't want to do anything like this ever. Now I probably would do it again. But the movie I wrote after that, after we finished post-production, was intentionally written. No special effects, no, you know, no big sets, just keep it all really small. And that turned out to be a really hectic shoot too. So now off of that, I'm going, all right, well, let's just do big sets again and some special effects. But no, I don't think I'm going to do any of the parody type stuff for a while. Just again, I think I was just so burned out after editing Inhuman, which then I'm like, I need a break from that. Yeah. Had it been finished a lot sooner, I'm sure I probably would have jumped right back into it and say, all right, let's do another one. Let's do, you know, I would love eventually to do, not science fiction, but I would love to do like a parody of 50s juvenile delinquent movies, gangster stuff, any like other genres. But 50s sci-fi, I think that just, you know, working 5 years on one movie of that kind, just sort of like, all right, I can't do it again for a long time. and the guys that, you know, crank them out like once a year, I admire the hell out of them, because I don't know how they're not getting burned out. But if they can keep going at it, more power to them.
Now, you're a big late night movie fan.
Yeah,
from what I can tell from your tweets and things. So I guess what are some of your favorite, you know, sort of obscure titles that that people may not have heard of?
I guess the one I would other than Interplanetary, one I would really love to shout out is Dark and Stormy Night by Larry Blamire,
okay,
who did Lost Skeleton of Cadavra. This was one that I think is better. I know the Lost Skeleton movies are his most famous, but he did one that was just a parody of an old Dark House mystery, and the writing in that is so impeccable. It's one of those, like, I'm jealous of how good this is. I wish I could write dialogue this funny. Or, you know, so like, I like, my first reaction when you said that would be like, well, I'd list a lot of like 50 sci-fi movies, because that's what we just were just talking about. But I realized probably none of the ones I would mention are really unheard of, you know, like everyone's seen The Blob, Thing from Another World, stuff like that. So it's like, eh.
Yeah. You mentioned Thing from Another World. That's Howard Hawks.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's one I still haven't seen. I'm a Howard Hawks fan. I just rewatched His Girl Friday, which is not sci-fi, but
yeah, that's one of my favorite. That, the way he directs dialogue is the that's the biggest influence on me of pretty much anything. I both Inhuman, which and the last movie I did, the scripts were a good like 9,500 pages, something like that. And the rule of thumb is it's one page of screenplay equals 1 minute of screen time. But I have people talking so fast in my movies because of Howard Hawks that Inhuman, which wound up being, 72 minutes? So, yeah. And I know some of it was just because stuff we cut, but that's a good, page and a half of script for 1 minute of screen time. I mean, it Howard Hawks gets people to talk so fast, it baffles me.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember sitting there watching it, and I'd seen it before. I watched it in college and fell in love with it. And then I showed it to my wife before we were married, but I showed it to her, and she fell in love with it. It's one of our favorite movies. But I was rewatched it for the first time in, probably a decade. And people give a lot of credit to, like Kevin Smith and some of these modern filmmakers for, the whole mumblecore phenomenon and these dialogue driven narratives. Howard Hawks was doing that in the 40s.
Right. Yeah.
And I was just blown away. I'm like, I forgot just how good this was. And like the zingers are just coming, and they're a mile a minute. You've got five people all talking at once, but it all makes right. sense. Like you can follow it. I don't even understand how. Like how am I? I can't comprehend how I'm able to process everything that's happening on the screen. But you do. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's because he gets people to talk like they do in real life, which no one's. I don't say one sentence and then. Someone else doesn't wait for me to finish. Sometimes we're just talking all over. Or if there's a bunch of us in a room, we're not going one by one. It's a mess of people talking all at once. And that to pull that off on screen is, that is a big deal for me.
I'm kind of curious, sort of on the business side. I mean, you guys, did you guys end up going with a distributor?
We knew like, okay, this is not going to get a theatrical distribution. We intentionally went straight to video. And just when it was time, when our movie was done, I just put out feelers to like, hey, does anyone know a good distributor who's not going to dick us over? And I have some friends in Minnesota who make something called Transylvania Television, which is a great internet puppet show. Look it up. It's wonderful. And they said, yeah, we use a company called Leomark. And so I just emailed them out of the blue and said, hey, the Transylvania TV people recommended you. Do you want to take a look at my movie? And they were like incredibly honest. They said, a black and white comedy is going to be impossible to sell, but we'll go for it. And they've been great ever since. Like really, really artist friendly. And they kind of knew that once it got onto Amazon Prime in that mix of all those other horror comedy movies where, if you like Inhuman Witch, you'll also like Llamageddon and Killer Donuts. Right. And they knew that like that's where it belongs, and I think that's the reason it's doing so well is because of the Leomark guys. They knew what they were doing.
Yeah, that's cool. And yeah, and that's I see it there all the time, and it's mixed in with those titles you mentioned, and stuff like Carousel and Pinata. Or something about Attack
Killer
of the
Pinata,
Killer Pinata.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of these where I've not even watched them, but I've seen so many tweets of it's just a list of like, here are the bunch of dumb titles they have on Prime. And it's Inhuman Witch, Killer Pinata, Killer Donuts. It's always the same like five or six movies. And I'm like, well, I know you're probably making fun of my dumb title, but... it's in the right group of movies for the right audience that I want. So yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because anybody that the sort of comes to it from there, I think, is the type of audience that you're looking for. I mean, that's who you're,
right.
you're sort of bringing the movie to. Like you said, it's not something that's going to go it's going to go wide and broad theatrically, but there's a market out there for it.
Yeah, and it's one that I didn't know existed until we put the movie out there. It was like I said, I thought this movie was just gonna fizzle away. Like, no one's gonna find this thing, no one's gonna want to watch it, but somehow it manded up in this puddle of horror comedies that all get clumped together, and I'll take it.
Yeah,
that recommendation on Prime or on Tubi or wherever, that is going directly to the audience that we didn't think existed when we were making it. These sort of, you know, weirdos who like oddball comedy,
yeah,
and who don't mind a movie with no budget. Like, they're willing to say, like, as long as it's fun, I don't care what it looks like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It is, and that's kind of the point. That's one of the things that I like. I like an entertaining story, and if you can. You know, if you can throw in, you know, something that's just kind of goofy and dumb, you know, to laugh at. Yeah. Like, there's scenes in Lamageddon where people are getting sprayed with blood, and it's clearly just like somebody firing out of spraying out of a garden hose.
Right.
but it's just sort of dumb and stupid, but it's funny, and that's part of the joke. And the important thing is, like, you can really tell that the people making it are having a good time. And,
yeah, yeah.
That's what I think makes
that,
it.
That goes a long way into rescuing something that's made on the cheap. That, you know, if it's a fun movie, like, the fun they're having on set just sort of spills out on you, and you're like, yeah, okay, this is fun, even if it's not funny.
Yeah,
I'll have a good time watching it. Like, you know, yeah, the jokes are meh, but yeah, I'm having a good time.
Exactly. All right, well, David, listen, I appreciate your time. I know it's kind of getting late in the evening, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I really really appreciated you coming on and thanks for having me. Do you want to tell people, where they can find you, or is there anything that you want to plug while I have you?
Just Inhumane, which, if you haven't seen it, and we haven't spoiled it all for you, which you can't really spoil this movie. it's on Amazon Prime and it's on Tubi. I love Tubi. They've got a bunch of weird junk on there.
Oh yeah.
Other than that, I got nothing. Just, I don't know, just be nice to people, I guess. That's, I don't know.
All right. No, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah, everyone check out Inhumane, which, and I assume is the same company. They are also doing the DVD distribution, yes, as well. Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that, the DVD actually was, I'm trying to remember the order it came out. But yeah, they handle, it's one of those manufacturer on demand discs, so it saves them a lot of money.
Yeah,
they, you know, they're not losing any money whenever you order one. It really helps a lot. And yeah, the DVD, I completely forgot that it has a bunch of our other short films that we did at the time. It's got video on there. Yeah, we just put a bunch of extra junk on there.
Yeah,
for the few people who still do physical media.
Yeah, and I like to, especially like when there's, especially, you know, when I know that there's there's extra features, whether it's commentaries or behind the scenes footage or other short films. I think it's the unfortunate thing is, once a movie hits streaming, then it just sort of immediately gets pirated, and you know, the sort of the net incremental price of it drops to zero. But if you put something, so you're trying to, you know, give people something that they can't get, or right, that's not available, and you shouldn't have to do that, but it's fun. It's one of the fun things about collecting physical media.
Yeah. Although the pirating, I don't understand, because I tell people it's available free like in 12 different places online. You really don't need to, you know,
right,
save the bandwidth and just, you know, don't worry about the torrent. Just go to YouTube. It's on there. It's fine.
The DVD's out there, and Tubi got so much good stuff on Tubi. I almost feel like they're trying to keep up with Amazon, with their sort of, you know, their wacky, insane, you know, collection of goofy stories. Because Amazon's got a good collection of it, but Tubi's really been, you know, stepping up acquisition in that space lately too.
Yeah, they'll take anything, it feels like, and which can be rough sometimes. But you know, if they're, you can find some really good when someone's taking anything, you can find some really good stuff in there, among with the junk.
yeah, and it usually doesn't take that long to figure out. You know, whether somebody's actually put some effort into something or not.
And thank you out there for listening and putting up with this nonsense. As always, if you want to interact with me, let me know what you thought of any of these movies, trailers, shorts, anything that we talked about. You can find me on Twitter at FinHorror or at NSFAPod, or shoot me an email, notsuitablepod@gmail.com. Or head over to Anchor and find me there, anchor.fm/NSFAPod, and send me a voice message, and I just might use it on the show. David, thanks very much again. I really, really appreciate you. Really appreciate you jumping on, and you know, I want you to have a great evening.
All right, thanks, man.
All right, thank you.